Good afternoon. I'm Charles Wolforth. This is Hometown Alaska. Our topic today is an intense one. We have police officers who are sworn to protect us and to keep the peace in Anchorage, and they're the people in our society who have the ability to take lives legally when they're faced with situations where their life or the lives of others appear to be in danger. What a difficult job, what a stressful job to have to make that kind of decision on the spur of the moment, and unfortunately it's been made twice this summer in Anchorage. Shane Tosse was killed in Mountain View during a confrontation which he had a stick and was coming towards a police officer. And then Harry Smith was shot in another incident in which he appeared to be threatening an officer with a gun, turned out to be some kind of a non-lethal weapon, but I guess the officer didn't know that. So our discussion today is about these incidents and about the general policy of how the police use force in Anchorage, how those decisions are made. They work for us, after all. They protect us, and they also have to deal with people who are out of control or whatever. And so it's going to be a broad-ranging discussion, and we will have community member who is been involved in minority discussions with the police department later, and also a national expert on the topic. But for the whole hour, Police Chief Mark Mew is in the studio with me to talk about this. And Chief Mew, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you very much, Charles, for having me on the show.
Now, these are unusual incidents. To have two of them happen in one summer or in the course of a matter of weeks is pretty unusual in Anchorage, isn't it?
Yes, it's unusual. We never like to have them. Having two back-to-back gets people asking what's going on. I don't think there's really anything different going on. I think it's just fate that we had two relatively close to each other.
Mm-hmm. And in both cases, there are people who were not particularly, they weren't bank robbers trying to get away from the police. There are people who essentially appear to have been behaving irrationally. I mean, is that true, or is that, I mean, that's a large part of the police's business, isn't it? Dealing with people whose behavior, because of anger or drugs or alcohol or anything else, makes it difficult to reason with them.
I would say in both these cases, the people who are in heightened emotional states, I would say behaving irrationally. I think they differ in certain ways. In the first one with Mr. Tosse, he was behaving in a bizarre way and generated several 911 calls before we got there. We know now that he had some of the synthetic marijuana in his system. I don't know to what degree, also alcohol. And so I think there's a lot of things going on there. With the case of Mr. Smith, I think we had a person who had suicidal and depression type issues for some time, had some history there, and had telegraphed his intent to commit suicide or have us do it for him.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the case of Shane Tosse, this was a person who was behaving, as you say, violently, angrily, had been sort of smashing around, and the police were called several times. The officer shows up, and what does he encounter? What does the officer see when he gets there?
Well, the officer who was confronted by Tosse was standing at the end of a walkway, probably 30 feet from the front door of Mr. Tosse's apartment, talking with three of the complainants. These complainants had been on the phone with us up until seconds before this and had tried to intervene, get into the apartment, and stop the fight that was going on inside. And they called in a lot of descriptions about what was going on there. While the officer was talking with these three, before he even approached the door, Mr. Tosse came out with a stick and immediately started in the direction of these now four people talking. Two of the four saw him and ran. The other one stayed next to the officer. The officer drew his weapon, ordered Tosse to stop. Tosse continued swinging the stick, and when he swung at the officer's head, the officer fired, I think, three rounds.
Mm-hmm.
The whole event transpired in about 4 seconds. That's not much time. There were no other officers in the immediate area, although some were coming in to the area, and one was, I'm going to guess 30, 40 yards away, but in a crossfire situation and unable to provide immediate help, not the kind of help you can get in 3 or 4 seconds. We had officers in there, you know, within 30, 40 seconds, I think, you know, their officers starting to show up. Mm-hmm. I might be a little bit off on some of those times, but there were officers in the general area looking for the problem, but the problem had not surfaced yet until it was right in our officer's proximity.
Right. So he had a broom handle, a broken off broom handle, and he was coming towards the officer. Was he a big guy, or what's, give us a sense of like the, I mean, you could, I suppose, try to tackle him or try to fight him physically. As there's a choice there, right?
Well, an officer always has to make choices on what he or she can do. And certainly your own size and state of fitness and state of skill measured against the size and strength and an apparent skill level of commitment of your adversary, all those things, you know, go into the analysis. Mind you, that analysis takes place in a couple of seconds. In this case, the officer was, you know, felt he was being swung at, felt that he was going to take that hit in the side of the head. That would probably cause him to lose consciousness, lose control of his weapon. He still has an obligation to protect this citizen who's standing right next to him. Commands were given. You know, a uniformed police officer drawing a gun says, "Stop, freeze, please." That did not stop Mr. Tosse at all. Mm-hmm. And the officers, I'm sure, I don't know if they asked him this actual question. They may have. They probably did. But, you know, an officer in that situation is probably saying, "What the heck do I have here?" You know, and people say, "Well, why didn't he get in a fist fight?" Well, he's got a gun out. You don't get in a fist fight with a gun out. You got to protect somebody else. You might lose control of that gun. He didn't happen to have a taser. Not everybody carries tasers, but we have many on the shift, and those are helpful when you can get a standoff situation where you have time to get set up and get ready to deliver that kind of a thing, but not when basically it's all coming down right on top of you. And as you can tell from...
And we can get into some more of that later in terms of the different options that you're given. I want to give out the phone numbers for folks who have questions for the chief on this subject or others, I suppose. The phone number here in Anchorage is 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage is 888-353-5752. Email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. I can read those questions on the air. And note that we're talking in the 2 o'clock hour. If you're listening at the 8 o'clock hour, it's a recording and you shouldn't call in. There's additional information for listeners at alaskapublic.org. Just click on Hometown Alaska. You'll find some news links to these incidents that we're talking about, background on some of our guests. And there's certainly been a lot of news coverage, and there's even a security camera video of the Shane Tosse shooting. And now I'd like to invite another guest. Kaneia Hirata is the vice president of the Polynesian Association of Alaska and has been involved in the discussion that's been going on between the Polynesian community in particular and the and APD in discussing concerns that they have about this shooting and was it justified. And Kaneia, thank you for being with us. What are the main concerns that you've been focusing on or that you'd like to see addressed?
Well, I know that we want the report. The Polynesian Association of Alaska has asked for the police report on the Tosse shooting, and we still haven't had that because there's still a lot of, we've been reaching out to the clergy members. Here in Anchorage, there's about 25 plus Samoan elders or ministers, and so we've been talking to them about the situation and trying to make them understand what we're trying to do and what we're trying to do with the police, with APD in addressing the situation. I feel like, and a lot of people have felt that it's been swept under the carpet.
So
the Tosse shooting.
Do you feel like it was a unjustified shooting, or do you feel like you just want more information to make up your mind?
Yeah, we just want more information. But personally, I feel like three shots is, I don't think that's justifiable. Like, one shot maybe, but three is kind of extreme. And I know that maybe from that experience when Mr. Smith was shot, I know he was shot five times, according to something I read, but they used a non-lethal, I guess, type of bullet. Is that correct?
I think they originally started with a foam bullet. It was unsuccessful, and they went to the lethal bullets. Yeah.
Well, we'll so get. I think that came from
that. So you're concerned about, like, what other methods could have been used? Have you felt like the department has been responsive? And you said you want to see that police report, but I know there have been a number of meetings. Have you attended those meetings, and have you felt like you're getting listened to?
Well, we just have the same questions, and Officer Mew, Chief Mew, has all our questions that we have asked, and our community, the leaders of our community, are still waiting for some concrete answers. So we've had meetings, and we've talked about it in length. They've given us, they didn't tell us, like, in detail, and that's all we're asking, like, you know, not what happened, this is what happened, and this is it. Like, we feel like there's more. The community needs to heal. The community needs to learn all the facts about what happened. From the beginning to the end. My main concern was, I'm a mother. I have four children. We spoke to Mr. Tossi's wife days after the incident, and she wasn't able to see her husband for about almost a week. But just being with her and visiting her with her children, her three children, and her story of how she was in a laundry room locked up with three children, ages 1, 2, and 3, and one of the children didn't have a shirt on. I mean, I think that's kind of. I mean, is that showing compassion?
So you feel, you know, that was disrespectful and not compassionate? Yeah. Let me let the chief respond to some of these points. And I guess there's a couple of there, but let's start first with the information flow. Is there information that has not been released, or that you feel will be released in the future, or do you feel like you've really given all the information you can?
Well, I've been talking and making appearances on this subject an awful lot lately, and I am I feel like, notwithstanding, we're not getting our message understood very well, and it's not for lack of trying. A number of meetings are being scheduled right now, and many of them have been out published here and are circulating around amongst interested community groups, so people should know about more of them that are coming. But we've had several of them already, and I think we'll continue to do those sorts of things. I guess it's going to take a while and a lot of repetition before we make it through everybody who wants to hear from us. And that's my job, and I'm perfectly willing to do it. Regarding requests for information, we have been flooded with requests for tapes, audio tapes, videotape, police reports, other documents from all the media outlets and lots of individuals and some attorneys. The discovery rules, the rules of public records, the rules of confidentiality, the victims' rights laws, all impact on who can get what when and how much of it can be released unredacted and how much has to be redacted and which way, depending on the audience that's going to receive it. Many, many laws that are very complicated drive those decisions. So all of the requests for information go through the municipal attorney's office, and I'll tell you, they are swamped processing all the requests from several of these big events we've had lately. So frankly, I do not specifically recall that that the Polynesian Association of Alaska has asked for the police reports. However, they may well have done that, and that may have been in the queue with the rest of the requests over at the city attorney's office. We have been providing much of this information, some of it in a redacted form. And of course, now we're getting requests for unredacted material.
Right. Let me ask you about this issue about the wife of the man who was shot, Shane Tosse. I guess his her attorney raised the point at the press conference that she was held in the laundry room for 20 minutes and then was questioned rather than being allowed to go to her husband's side. What was that within your policy, or what was the was that? I mean, I think the concern is that that's not a sensitive way to treat somebody whose husband has just been shot. But I suppose there may be other reasons for doing it.
I'm going to have to answer this delicately. And I also must tell you that there might be a point or two that I don't know the answer to. But in general terms, we just had a shooting. There were police and medics providing CPR and other first aid. We have a crime scene. No one is allowed to get in the middle of that, as hard as that sounds to say and as callous as that sounds. There's not a place for emotional family in the middle of that thing. Now, mm-hmm. Mr. Tosse was put into an ambulance and taken to the hospital. I know our people had to clear the residence. They had to protect the crime scene in the residence. They needed to get some initial information from witnesses. And they do have the statutory right and an obligation to detain people briefly to get that information. I don't know about this allegation of locking people in a laundry room. It could be that the laundry room was the only place to stand that wasn't in the crime scene, because if you look at photographs of that residence, you could see that that's part of the investigation, and walking around in that type of environment is not going to be something detectives are going to allow anyone to do. So perhaps, and I'm just speculating here, the laundry room was just the available private space that was there at the time. I've been told that after that, access was, in at least in some part of the hospital's policy. We would have no interest in determining those things either way. So I think I need to learn more about just how that played out. I don't claim to have all the facts there, but taking the allegations I've heard in that regard at face value seemed like a stretch to me.
All right. It's Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. My guest in studio is Chief of Police Mark Mew, and on the line, we have a representative from the Polynesian Association of Anchorage, Kaneo Hirata. And Kaneo, I wanted to ask you about the mood of the Polynesian community, and you mentioned the need for healing. There was also an incident last month, which KSKA Radio has just been reporting on, of a near riot or some kind of a altercation that required a lot of police to show up at Lions Park in Mountain View. What is the mood of the Polynesian community in general about this, and is there a feeling of fear or hostility about the police, or just could you characterize the feelings that you have perceived?
The feelings that I have is, we didn't know about it until we had this task force meeting, so we weren't aware of that. And it happened, it didn't come on the news or anything. Mm-hmm. But I think it could have happened to anyone. It's not a racial thing.
I mean, when you talk about healing, are you talking about healing in the family or
I'm
the community in total?
Healing as a community. Like, this is really... to me, I mean, I love Alaska. I love living here. But this has really put a heavy load on all of us, and no matter what you are, what race you are. And I think that we need to heal. We need to help each other understand what happened and the things that have happened. I know that on your radio show, I don't think yours specifically, but I know that on talk radio, people have been calling in, and there's this public outcry for an internal board of review, you know, for the police. that has subpoena power to be able to investigate and to see, but someone from the outside, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've heard that on talk radio.
That's something
I've
you
seen
feel?
It, I've read it on ADN, and I think that's maybe something that APD should consider or the mayor's office should consider. I know in other places, other cities, they have an organization or like an internal review board that comes in and does an investigation, and they find the different things that needs to, so kind of like
a police to watch over the police, essentially.
Yes, exactly.
Let me turn those questions to the chief. I want to ask this one last question for you, Kaneo. I mean, is how much discussion will be enough? Obviously, you feel like you're not there yet. More meetings needed, or does it need to go, as you said, to some kind of arbitrator or disinterested party that looks at it? Or how do we know when we're getting through this issue?
Well, I don't think it's going to heal in 3 months, 4 months. It may take a year. It may take more than that. Mm-hmm. Until the people are satisfied, the community, until okay. people really understand and we know the facts, what happened from point A to point Z. We want all, it's just, we feel, the community feels that there's missing pieces. You know, and here we have a family. We're all in this together. Now we're going to have to take care of this family, you know?
Mm-hmm.
3 kids, no father, and she's going to give birth soon. And it's unfortunate that he had to die.
Yeah.
Really unfortunate.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Kaneo Hirata, who is the vice president of the Polynesian, Hirata, vice president of the Polynesian Association of Anchorage. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Chief Mew, I wanted to ask you about this sense of is the community explosive in some sense? So there was this incident that took place, hard to interpret exactly what happened or why, where there was an altercation in the park while the police were dealing with that. Lots of other people showed up. The police department felt it was necessary to flood a lot more officers in there to keep control of the situation. Have you felt like there is a more tense atmosphere that the police are dealing with because of this incident and the other one?
Well, Charles, that was the takeaway that I got when my folks reported or brought that matter to my attention. It's an isolated incident. It's only happened once, and I really, really want to avoid having anything like that happen again. Of course, from where I sit, I'm talking with like folks like Kaneo here, and I understand their sense of frustration and their desire to learn more about us and get over misunderstandings and so forth. So I'm seeing it at my end, and something like this suggests to me that the officers are feeling it at their end. And mm-hmm. I'll be honest with you, I haven't heard of any other events besides this one, but the prospect scared me enough that I really wanted to do something to see that we don't have it again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I raised the issue recently at the Police Community Relations Task Force, because that's an organization that has the charter, if you will, the mission to help the city get through circumstances like these incidents or concerns like these in the community. I thought that would be a good place to start. I have heard from members of this community that they really would like a greater role in helping better the relations between the police and our residents. And so I thought, well, this would be a good thing for them to take up if they were willing to do it.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to go to a call now. Norm is calling for Palmer. Norm?
Hi, this is for the chief. I want to say right off, I don't want to see the officer. This is for the shooting of the guy with the stick. I don't want to see the officer strung up or prosecuted or anything like that, but you said the incident happened in 4 seconds. If I knew this guy was irrational, I'd want to put myself in a position to have more than 4 seconds. and to give the person ample warning, more than just freeze police and then fire away. Again, you're not in the position to say, right now you'd lose your job if you agreed with me, but I think it would go a long way with the community eventually if you just said, yeah. In this particular circumstance, he put himself in a bad position, and he used force that was unnecessary on a person with a stick. I'll take my comments off the air.
Chief?
If you look at the video, I think you can see that the officer never approached Mr. Tosse. The officer was standing at the edge of the parking lot speaking with witnesses. So he didn't put himself in the vicinity of Mr. Tosse. Mr. Tosse put himself in the vicinity of the officer. Now, the officer could have run away, but that would be abandoning the citizen that was there. Now, I know there's discussion about whether there are intermediate means of force that the officer could have used. The debate is whether those would have been effective under these circumstances. But the law allows the officer to determine when he or she feels overwhelmed and that lives are in danger. And that's the perception of the person at the time, and there's a legal standard for that. And we don't apply 20/20 hindsight to override what the officer felt at the time. So I'm not certain that, you know, I know I talk a lot about legal standards and so forth, and I guess maybe folks want to get away from that and just talk in general terms about how they feel about it. But unfortunately, we live in sort of an environment where the rule of law and written procedures and things like that are what guide what we do. And this one obviously is not an easy one for the public to accept. We acknowledge that, and so I think it's going to take a lot of talking.
Yeah. Well, this issue of other things that the officer could have done, of course, second guessing is easy when you're not in that position, but it's a good thing to talk about in terms of policy anyway. Here's an emailer who asks, are police officers permitted to shoot bullets with the intention of incapacitating the suspect, such as shooting the legs? I think that is a question that immediately comes to you when you think, well, this guy is, you know, maybe he's irrational, maybe he's gone crazy and he's attacking you, but is there any alternative other than shooting to kill?
I've spent so much time talking about this point. We don't shoot to kill. We also don't shoot for extremities. We don't shoot to wound or to warn. And I don't think you will find a modern police department, a modern Western police department, that will do that. Policing got away from that many, many years ago, and it would go against all modern training, modern policy, industry standards, and probably case law if we were to get into that. Look at the number of innocent people shot in New York recently, for instance.
The case at the Empire State Building where the police fired a number of times at a guy who'd recently committed a murder, and they ended up wounding 8 people, I believe.
I don't know the circumstances of that case other than what I read in the media, and I am not weighing in or pointing fingers one way or the other on that. I'm just pointing out how dangerous it gets when bullets are flying around. And these things go down fast. Often people are in motion. Often you have poor lighting, you have to communicate, you have to think, you have to watch out for other people you're trying to protect, watch for a crossfire. It's very dynamic. It's not like going to the range and shooting at targets. And if you try and couple that with the expectation that you're going to hit very small moving targets like hands, arms, legs, knees, things like that, it just isn't safe for anybody. It doesn't work. And it endangers everyone.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's a tough topic today in Hometown Alaska. We're talking about the recent police shootings that took place this summer, the policies and the decisions that police officers have to make. My guest is Police Chief Mark Mew. We're going to continue in a moment after a break. I'll be giving out phone numbers for more of you to get on the air with us and continue the discussion. Please stay with us.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website, alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA FM 91.1.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about police shootings, the use of lethal force, and the two controversial shootings that have taken place over the summer. Police Chief Mark Mew is with me in the studio. In a moment, we're going to have a national expert to talk about these incidents. But I wanted to make sure that you had the phone number and information to get involved in the discussion as well. The number, if you're within the Anchorage area, is 550-8433. From outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. Email hometown@alaskapublic.org. And if you go online to alaskapublic.org and click on Hometown Alaska, you'll find some links, including information about our guests and some links about news reports for the two shootings we're talking about. We've spent the first half hour talking a lot about the Shane Tosse shooting. The Harry Smith shooting was a bit different. Mr. Smith, I guess, was in his own backyard, was behaving erratically, had a weapon, which turned out to be a BB gun or a pellet gun. I guess it had both capabilities, but was a replica of a real gun. His son had, as I understand it, told the police that he was depressed and potentially was trying to commit suicide by cop, which is the very strange concept of doing something that causes the police to come and kill you intentionally. The police went to the location and tried to subdue him with a non-lethal round, were unsuccessful, and ended up, when he threatened them with this replica weapon, ended up killing him. I just wanted to ask, Chief Mew, is that about right? Is that sort of the chain of events that happened?
Yes, that's insofar as you went there, those... At a high level, that's mm-hmm. what occurred.
Right. Now, what was this non-lethal weapon that was used to try to take to subdue him?
Well, the less lethal weapon we used was a 40-millimeter launcher that can fire a variety of less lethal options, different kinds of soft kinetic projectiles, various forms of chemical agents. It's a versatile piece of equipment, and the rounds they chose are sort of a hard foam, harder than a Nerf ball, but still sort of foamy. And they fired two rounds with that. Of course, we're jumping to the end of the story here, mm-hmm. but that was the first, that was, the intent was to use that to disarm Mr. Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And when you deploy less lethal, whenever you can, you try and set up so that you've got someone with lethal capability right next to you, because if it doesn't work and the situation escalates instead of de-escalates, then you're stuck because you're just holding an empty and formerly ineffective, less lethal platform, and you'd have no way to respond then to a the suspect if he used deadly force against you. So we always have try and have somebody right there, and so that if your less lethal application fails and it's necessary, there's somebody who's ready to go to work with the lethal response.
Right. Now, Mr. Smith's son originally said that he had told the dispatcher that the gun was a replica, was a BB gun, but on listening to those tapes, it proves that he didn't actually make that statement. So the officers really didn't have a way of knowing that it wasn't a real gun. Is that true?
Well, it is very true that Russell Smith did not tell the 911 call takers that his father had access to or was likely in possession of a replica gun or a BB gun or a pellet gun or anything like that. He did clearly say that his father was going to try and trick the police into killing him and look out for a cell phone. He might pull a cell phone out of his pocket, something along those lines. He mentioned a cell phone. Don't remember the exact words now. He said that his father is claims to have a gun now. This is later in the conversation. The tapes go for a while, like probably half an hour or something of that nature. And towards the end, he said his father said he had a gun and he's going out in the yard and he's going to finish this up, or words to that effect. We quizzed him about whether or not that was how confident he was that he had a gun. And Russell Smith said, let us know that he felt the family guns were locked up. So we didn't know what gun his father would be referring to, but that he definitely said he had one. That's all you hear on the 911 tapes. Mr. Russell Smith later said he also told officers outside that his father had a BB gun or whatever. And our officers all have been asked that question and all are adamant that they never heard anyone say that. In any event, they did know that there's a chance that they would be baited into shooting at this suspect. And when he brought out what looked like a gun, they fired, even though that's lethal force, they still fired two rounds of less lethal. And he was struck once, came back up on target, and then the officers with the lethal weapons fired.
All right. I'd like to welcome another guest to the show, Professor David Klinger. Is at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He's also an author of a book called Into the Kill Zone. He's a national expert on the subject and a former police officer himself, I believe. Professor Klinger, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What are what options are police departments across the country looking at for this getting around this issue of an officer who is dealing with someone who is maybe irrational but and is threatening, but maybe doesn't have a real weapon or has a weapon that's not as lethal as a gun? Are there options there that are logical to adopt, or is it really the officers in the position of having to use the gun most of the time?
Well, I think you've given me a pretty broad spectrum there, from not being armed with a lethal weapon to something that may be lethal but not as lethal as a gun, and it really all depends. And I'll just talk generically for a minute and see if that's helpful. Let's say you have an individual with a knife. Well, you have an individual with a knife. One of the things you want to do is you want to keep distance from that individual. And I heard the chief talking about the less lethal munitions that his officer used apparently in this one situation. That would be a perfect example of a situation where the chief is correct. You want to have lethal cover. You want to have your less lethal there. You fire the less lethal to get this individual with a knife to drop it. And if he hangs onto the knife and he doesn't drop it, so be it. You don't shoot unless and until he starts making an aggressive movement to the officers. Now, what I'm assuming is some distance between the officers and the suspect. So, yes, there are ways that we try to manage the space in which the suspect is, where the officers are going to be positioned, so on and so forth. When you have a firearm, however, it changes the dynamic to a great extent, because as the chief points out, if someone starts to bring a firearm to bear, any reasonable officer is going to believe that his or her life is in imminent jeopardy, and deadly force would be an appropriate response. So it really depends on a lot of things, and I'm just trying to give you a generic distinction between a knife and a gun.
What are some of the tools that are available that can be brought to bear? Are there any new technologies or anything that can be brought into the field to avoid these tragedies?
It depends, once again, on the circumstance. One of the things that you can do sometimes in some circumstances, you could use an armored vehicle and have the officers deployed in an armored vehicle, have your negotiator inside the armored vehicle, and so that even if the individual does point the gun, and let's assume that we know for sure that it is a pistol round that is not going to penetrate as opposed to armor-piercing rifle rounds or something, the officers can sit inside the armored vehicle, and we don't have to worry as much about an officer being injured as we would if the officers, let's say, only had a patrol vehicle to protect them. There are a variety of less lethal munitions. The chief talked about impact munitions. There are also tasers that may be something would be appropriate in a very narrow band of circumstances where an individual is armed with a firearm, but that's something that we're not typically going to use. There is another type of electronic stun device, for lack of a better term, that is actually fired out of a long barrel weapon, typically a shotgun, made by Taser International, called an X-Rep. So there are various things. Gas could be deployed, pepper ball. There's a variety of tools that could be used, but it all depends on the circumstance. Let's say that what happened is two patrol officers respond to a call of a distraught individual in public space with a firearm, akin to what happened in New York. We don't have time to mobilize your SWAT unit. You don't have time to call up officers who are going to be armed with these, what we might call exotic less lethals. The officers have to simply use what they have on their belt to deal with the circumstance, and unfortunately, oftentimes, deadly force is the only option.
I'd like to bring a caller on with this to talk to the chief or our national expert, Scott from Anchorage. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I have a question. Actually, I have two questions for the chief after listening to the expert. The first question is, does APD have an armored vehicle?
The answer to the question is yes, we do. We have a state-of-the-art armored vehicle.
Is that right? Has it been deployed?
We have used it. We didn't have time to get it out in this case. It comes with the SWAT team, and this event resolved way before we were able to get SWAT team called out and to the scene.
I was unaware of that. That's very interesting. My original question was, my question is this. It seems that the situations, these two situations, I'm not going to go into the details of them. I'm curious about what happened, but I believe that what happened was probably what was going to happen when the police did what they needed to do. But my real question is this. If I'm in a situation with a police officer, and the police officer has drawn his firearm, can I assume at that point, as a citizen of Anchorage, that if I do not obey his commands, he will shoot me? He's decided, when he drew his weapon and pointed it at me, that I am a threat, and that if I do not do what I'm told, I will be shot. Is that a reasonable thing for a citizen to believe now?
Good question. Chief?
An officer is allowed to threaten deadly force in situations where the use of deadly force is not quite, you haven't quite got to that level yet. So if an officer is drawn to guard, what we say is guard position, which is usually what they'd say, and he's giving you commands, and his commands would typically be, you know, stop, don't move, whatever. That situation is so delicate that the best thing for you to do is just comply with that until we sort out what the problem is here. Maybe you're the right guy, maybe you're not, but the officer's obviously got something in mind, and I wouldn't try to provoke the situation and make it get worse. Ultimately, though, if the officer uses deadly force, he or she has to articulate why that was and why whatever your response was going to put them at risk of imminent serious physical injury or death, or some other bystander in the same predicament. So, you know, if he told you don't move and you stood there wiggling your finger, no, that he wouldn't be authorized to fire on that. But if he told you don't move and you plunged your arm into your coat and started pulling your hand out real fast, you know, he might determine that you were about to draw on him, and he might fire.
All right. Thanks for the call, Scott. I want to ask Professor Klinger, You've heard the chief talking about the policies of our department up here a bit. Obviously, you don't know about them comprehensively, but my question is, are these police policies pretty standard around the country? Is there a sort of a standard professional state of the art that most departments follow in these regards, or do different communities kind of have different ways of looking at it?
Yes and no. And the yes is that just about every police agency has some policy that talks about the use of deadly force that addresses two issues. And the chief hit on basically what we call the defense of life standard. Police officers are allowed to use deadly force to protect themselves or innocent third parties, a citizen or another police officer, from what we call imminent threats of serious bodily injury or death. The chief is spot on that. The other time when police officers are allowed to use deadly force in the United States is to stop the flight of a serious violent felon who is about to escape, and the officer has probable cause to believe that this person in fact committed a serious violent felony, one that involved the infliction or threatened infliction of serious bodily injury, and they need to use deadly force. It's necessary to use deadly force to stop the flight. So what happens, and then the Supreme Court in 1985 came out and said this in a case called Tennessee versus Garner, and they also say, and if feasible, some warning is given. So that's basically someone shoots his wife and is running down the street towards another group of people that if he gets there, he's going to shoot other people. You shoot that person so he can't escape and harm anybody else. That's basically it. So what many police agencies have is they basically have a policy that follows that, that says here's the two times when police officers are allowed to use deadly force. Some agencies, however, limit it to a defense of life policy, and I don't know what Anchorage says on that. So that's the basic answer. However, there are also a variety of different things that agencies do around the country to further restrict. So, for example, an officer might work for an agency where the policy says you will not shoot at or from a moving vehicle, or you will not shoot if certain circumstances are present, whatever the case might be. Police agencies are always allowed to put additional restrictions beyond what the Constitution and then whatever the state law in Alaska is, whatever those things are. But the basics of shooting in defense of life and then to stop the flight of a fleeing felon, those are the violent fleeing felon, those are the only two times that police officers in the United States have lawful warrant to use deadly force.
And Professor Klinger, I promise you we weren't going to keep you on for the whole show. I don't know if you can stay with us for another 10 minutes or so.
Oh, sure I can.
Okay, great. I'd like to take another caller then. Martha had a question about training, I believe. Martha?
Yes, I had a couple of questions because of the calls coming in.
Yeah, we've got a lot of callers, so just let's stick to one question
for
now.
I'll keep it short. Professor Klinger, what percentage of police departments in the country do you think have all their officers equipped with non-lethal weapons?
I don't know, and the reason I don't know is we don't even know exactly how many police agencies there are in the country. However, what I can tell you is every police agency that I am aware of, police officers have non-lethal weapon, at least in terms of a nightstick, a baton, collapsible baton, PR-24, whatever the case might be. That would be something that would be authorized in just about every agency. Some agencies are going to have pepper spray, some are going to have tasers, so on and so forth. But just about every police officer on the street in uniform is going to have something besides the firearm on his or her belt.
All right.
Okay, in Anchorage, we still haven't gotten the policies out there or the procedures that the police are operating under. And I had a couple of things that come to mind. If we don't have all the officers equipped with non-lethal weapons that are effective, like a taser or pepper spray, then it should be a policy, in my opinion, that officers responding to the scene should not be within the sight line of the potential perpetrator. And that if they that they should not be allowed to that they should have to wait for backup. The way that the chief says he just didn't happen to not have a non-lethal weapon. Well, that should change how they respond. And we have to ask why can't we afford to have officers properly equipped if that's what we need to do.
Let's take that one, Martha. Chief, I understand some officers have tasers, others don't. Do they carry pepper spray at all?
Charles. All officers carry batons and OC spray, pepper spray. Slightly less than half of the patrol force carries tasers. And then the remaining less lethal platforms tend to be with specialized officers, supervisors, and with SWAT. So they're available on the street. 40 millimeter, for instance, we probably have three or four of those on each shift. They may change hands with different experts because we have a limited number of those platforms. But we have all of this stuff out there on the street. It sometimes takes a while to get the officers in that have the special equipment to get there in time to use it. But we've been gradually and steadily increasing the taser fleet, increasing the percentage of officers that are carrying the taser. We're not at 100% yet. We are not convinced that 100% is necessarily the number we need. We're having some internal discussions on that right now. There is some expense to the program, but expense isn't the only consideration there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you mentioned all the...
Sure, go ahead, Professor.
If I might, and that is that the notion that a taser or OC spray or any other less lethal option is going to be effective is incorrect, and we have to understand that, and the chief was absolutely correct. If there is a deadly force threat potentially there, you cannot assume that the taser is going to work. You cannot assume that OC is going to work. You cannot assume that a 40-millimeter projectile is going to work. And people need to understand that. The taser is not a magical thing that works 100% of the time for a variety of reasons that we don't have time to get into right now. Same thing with chemical agents. And so I think it's very important that the citizens who are listening understand that just because a less lethal device is there, that means that would have that is going to resolve it, or if there wasn't one present, that would have resolved it.
All right, good. I want to go to Doug now. He's calling from Palmer with a training question. Doug?
Yes, good program. I was just going to comment that I think, unfortunately, in our state, that there's a problem with training of law enforcement officers, both at the city level and at the trooper level. And I had seen on the internet, maybe it was half a year ago, of a incident where an armed robber came to a hotel lobby, and as he was leaving the premises with his money, there happened to be a national convention for black belt instructors in town, and two of those instructors happened to be right there at the time. And they immediately disarmed him and had him on the floor in just within seconds. So I was just wondering, my question for the chief would be, are these instructors part of the police training? If not, might this be an option he might want to consider?
So in other words, training in martial arts or hand-to-hand combat?
Yeah, something to that effect.
Mm-hmm. Chief?
Well, certainly we have what we call defensive tactics. Everybody goes to the academy, learns certain empty-handed soft control, empty hard hand control. We use techniques that are derived from several different martial arts disciplines. And we do train our people to use those techniques, and they are part of our response to resistance continuum. We haven't got into this yet. We've been focusing all of our discussion on once you're into the use of less lethal or lethal equipment. But below that on the continuum are your, your hands-on kind of techniques. And we do train on those, and they get retrainers during the year as well. And below that on the continuum are things like your command presence and your ability to assert yourself and the ability to use your voice, your verbal skills to gain compliance. So it runs the gamut from just how you talk to people to right up to deadly force. And a big piece of that we haven't talked much about is the defensive tactics stuff, and we do teach it. And we hire experts from around the country to help us define the program and deliver the training that seems to work the best.
Great.
Can I jump in?
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, just to follow up on what the chief is saying and trying to respond a little bit more directly to one thing that I thought I heard the caller talk about disarming someone. Police officers are not trained, they should not be trained to disarm people who are armed with deadly weapons. There may be a time and a place because of just some bizarre circumstance where the officer cannot get to his or her firearm, and the only thing they have left is physical grappling. extremely, extremely dangerous. When I was a young police officer in Los Angeles, I made a mistake. I tried to disarm an individual who was armed with a knife, and I ended up shooting him. And the reason I say I got lucky. He stabbed my partner. He attacked me. I ended up having to shoot him. But the point is, I was 23 years old. I was in tip-top shape, and I would have bet my life. And, in fact, I risked my life to try to disarm this guy. I should have shot him straight away. And so I'm 6'4". I weigh 220 pounds. That's how big I was when I was a young police officer. I was strong. I was firm. Both my partner and I had grip on his hands. He pulled away. So the notion that police officers should be trained to disarm people who have deadly weapons is just wrong.
I have to agree there, and thanks for making the point, Professor. We do train on that stuff, but there's no way an officer is going to use those with somebody that's already got a weapon.
Well, it leads me to a question that I want to ask before we're done here, which is, I guess I'll turn first to you, Professor Klinger. It seems like, and in line with the anecdote you just told, that maybe the most important asset for the police officer in the situation is judgment, and trying to assess the situation and figure out what the best and safest course for everybody is. And you know, a lot of police officers are young and young, tough guys. I mean, is there a way of instilling good judgment and getting developing an ability to deal with situations peacefully that can be instilled in officers?
I think so, and a lot of it's going to go back to academy training and then your initial field officer training that you have, or field training officer program, whatever you guys call it up there, where officers are trained by veteran officers on the street how to make that transition from what is told in the academy to the street. And one of the things that can go on in a positive fashion is the older police officers tell the youngsters, hey, when you responded to this call that we just left, what were you thinking about? How did you approach? So on and so forth. Because one of the things that we know from a great deal of research and research on training is that if we train officers about how to approach circumstances a sizable chunk of the time, we can prevent the situation from escalating to a point where the officer is in jeopardy and has to resort to force, whether it's deadly force or some sort of less lethal force, whether it's physical grappling or a taser or whatever. And when you talk about judgment, in my mind, we need to teach young officers judgment at the beginning. When you first get that radio call or you first spot somebody that you're going to stop because you have reasonable suspicion that they're involved in some sort of criminal activity, how do you approach people? How do you talk to people? All those things are really important, mm-hmm. and that stuff can be trained.
Well, thanks so much. This has been fascinating, and the hour went by quickly. I'm sure there are a lot more questions out there. I want to thank my guest, Anchorage Police Chief Mark Mew. He's been very open and available, and that's been great, and I'm sure he'll be taking a lot more questions at upcoming community forums. Earlier, we heard from the Vice President of the Polynesian Association of Anchorage, Kaneo Hirata, and I also want to thank Professor David Klinger of the University of Missouri, St. Louis, who is also an author. His book is Into the Kill Zone, and you'll find links to that and everyone else on our website. Next week on Hometown Alaska, our host will be Shelley Wade. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is the Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.